Okay, so before I start with the main topic for today, which is a structure and exploiting structure, which is basically also the main topic for the next five classes, I mean, including today, I sent a couple of mails regarding the Netflix Prize paper. I don't know how many of you actually read it. I also tried to ask you some questions related to that on the blog, but I thought I'll just discuss them because, you know, some people did answer some things, but, you know, it might be useful to keep in mind this because these two things come free. You know, one of the advantages in any course is after you learn certain number of techniques, then a new technique can be seen as just a conglomeration of existing ones, and that's when you know you've gotten a critical mass of ideas in the area. Okay, so when you open a paper and you don't need to figure out, you know, where is this para coming from, this para coming from, you can just say, oh, this must be, you know, they're just doing, in this particular case, collaborative filtering can be thought of in terms of the same kinds of analysis that we did on the document term matrix. Okay, so instead of on the IR side, you did DT matrix. Here you're doing UI matrix, right? DT is the document term user item. Okay, now we already noticed, I think I also mentioned last class, and in fact this is an important point to keep in mind, so I'll repeat it again here, that even though we acted as if Pearson correlation coefficient is a completely brand new way of computing similarity between ratings vectors, you can actually see that what Pearson correlation coefficient is doing is it is taking the rating vector here from the user item matrix, it's centering them. Centering essentially means for each row you subtract the mean of that row from each of the elements. So there will be minuses and pluses and zeros. Okay, negative values, positive values, zeros. And so that would be an actual vector. Now, if I have U1 has a vector, U2 has a vector, then essentially taking the vector similarity between these two vectors winds up being exactly equivalent to taking the covariance and dividing it by the two variances, the square roots of the two variances. Okay, because the covariance essentially is taking this, which is the centered term from the first vector, multiplying it by the corresponding centered term from the second vector, and it's adding them up. That's just the dot product of the two vectors, right? Okay, so it's always good to not have to know too many new concepts, right? Because if it's the same idea, then you can realize that they're all connected. And then similarly, for the variance which you divide, you know, you divide by the standard deviations of both the RA and RU, so the two users, right? And that is nothing but what it will do. A standard deviation really is basically RAI minus RA times itself added up. Okay, that's also another term for norm of the vector, the magnitude of the vector. Okay, so the advantage actually is that in fact whatever we saw last time was really applying vector similarity techniques to centered user item rows. Okay, now however the way we decided to use the vector similarity was to focus on users. That means given a new user to whom you want to recommend an item, you look for k closest users to this user. And then do, you know, after having found those closest users, then they use them to make the recommendation. Actually, this was one of the first ideas that came up in the collaborative filtering. But if you start thinking about this centered user item matrix, okay, you could use this to also compute the correlations between the items instead of talking about which user is closest to the active user. You can talk about, I am about to try and see whether a particular item, I should be recommended to the current user. Okay, and a different way of looking at that would be, look for what are the closest items to this item. What are the items that seem to be most correlated to this item? And then if you find them, then you can ask yourself, I mean, you can ask, and you can see whether the current user has rated any of those close by items. If they rated those items, then you could take the average of them and say that would be the rating for this item. This is an item centered way of doing the recommendation. Okay. So to do this, of course, you have to decide, figure out what items are close to what other items, and remember that the closest idea for this would be association clusters and scalar clusters, which we actually talked about for terms. Okay. So terms are items. Okay. So if I take UI prime times UI, then I get the II matrix, that is item-item raw correlation matrix. Then I can process it using association clusters. I can further process it using vectors, the scalar clusters, which takes essentially the vector similarities. Remember those two things you did in the midterm. Okay. This way, then essentially in this processed II matrix, each row corresponds to an item. This is the kth item, and then here are its correlations to all the other items. Okay, and then you can look for the each item, what are the, I mean, what this is, let's say ith item. Okay, and you could look for what are the items in this row that seem to be most correlated, which are the ones with the highest value. Presumably the item itself is correlated to itself very highly, unless it's one of these polarizing items. Okay. But then the question is, what are the other items that are close to it? And having found that, now you can go to the current user and see if the current user has ranked any of these other items. Right? If so, then you can take the rankings, the ratings of those items, you know, in fact, you can even weight them instead of just taking a simple average. You can take the correlation of the item to this item as the weight, times the user's rating for that item, divided by the sum of the correlation. This will give you a recommendation for this item, for this user. Suppose this winds up being a high enough number, then you would like to actually go and tell the user, maybe you want to buy this. Now, having said this, there's always this question, if you tell them that maybe they want to buy it, you want to justify why you are asking it. Now, this is one place where this idea shines over the collaborative, the user-centered view. Because in the user-centered view, remember I've been telling you that it's hard to get people to take a justification saying, people that we know that you don't know, who we think are like you, like this, so you should like this. It's very hard for you to, you know, take that justification as a real justification. Whereas in an item-centered way, you can actually say, look, we are saying that you would like this item because this item is correlated with this, this, and this item in terms of buying patterns, and you like those items. Okay? So there is a better way of actually evaluating justification at the user side. Okay? In particular, actually, suppose the user happens to know that they have given, suppose you said, we think that you might be interested in iPad because you bought all the other I things, iPod and iPhone, etc., right? And then and these are well correlated with iPad according to the global user analysis, and you have given high ratings to iPad and iPhone. Then you might say, hey, I was just giving them high ratings for no good reason. You know, I don't even have them. In which case, you actually know that this, you know, you can actually, in this particular case, say that if, in fact, the reason they think I would like iPad is because of my ratings of iPod and iPhone, since I never even bought them and I made up, you know, fake ratings for them, I can assume that this recommendation is not as meaningful, for example. Whereas that's such a thing you couldn't do if I just tell you that people like you seem to be buying this stuff, because I don't know who these people are. Yes?
So you are calculating an I matrix based on UI matrix.
Yeah.
Suppose one user is having some cost entries and U2 is not having that entry, and you are still calculating that matrix. So you are making some assumption.
Yeah, so that's a good point, and in fact that is a... So let me come to the next slide and, you know, keep that in mind. So I sort of assumed until now that, you know, UI matrix is sort of similar to DI matrix. Okay. The difference, of course, is the one thing is, just like the DT matrix, UI matrix is also sparse. Both are sparse. Sparse means in most of the entries they have no numbers. Okay? However, in the case of DT, if an entry, if the, you know, DI, I mean, if the entry DT IJ has no number in it, you assume it is zero. Why? Because this is the number of times jth keyword occurred in the ith document. And if I don't put anything, that means it occurred zero number of times. Okay, so documents are closed world. If I don't tell you that a word occurs in the document, that means that the word does not occur in the document. Ratings, on the other hand, are not closed world, they are open world. Okay, if I have, in terms of the sparsity, I could actually have a user, you know, when a user did not rate something, then it really is not that their rating is zero or even mu, which is the average of that particular user's ratings, but that really it is null value. Okay, remember in the databases, for example, you may have a tuple with some attribute missing. Okay, the color is missing, let's say, for a particular car in the, you know, in the database. What is the color supposed to be? Is it supposed to be zero? No, it's just missing. That means we don't quite know what its value is. Okay, so as much as I would like to believe that DT and UI are very similar, there is this one fundamental difference, which is that the sparsity here actually is a bad kind of sparsity. It comes because of null values. And we sort of are not surprised at this, because remember, towards the end of last class, we talked about how to, one way of removing this sparsity, which is kind of what's called the imputation method. This is a nice little jargon, but essentially, you say the ones that are not known, you just give them a value based on some reasoning. What was the idea we tried last class? The non-trivial idea we tried last class. What? No. Last class, we talked about a way of reducing the sparsity of the collaborative filtering method. No. That is, no. What? No. We combined content-based and collaborative filtering. We used a user's own values for, you know, items to learn a content-based classifier for that user, and then use that to fill up the missing values. And then we did the collaborative filtering. Remember, towards the, I mean, even if you don't remember what I was saying, you should be able to remember what, you know, my gesticulations, that, you know, there was this business of a content-based and collaborative filtering being combined. And then we also talked about, if you could do that, why can't we just do that for a simple classifier itself, you know, which basically has a whole bunch of unlabeled data. Anyway, so the point is, you could do imputation methods. In that particular case, the imputation method involved actually learning a content-based filter, if you know how to do that. Okay. A less interesting approach would be also something that I discussed last class, which is just assume all the missing values are not zeros, but rather the average value for this user, average values of the ratings for this user. Now, it's not a foolproof method at all. Okay, but that's approximately what you could do in doing this. And another idea, which actually, you know, which also helps us talk about this question, you know, how to deal with reducing the sparsity. And by the way, this sounds like a dumb thing to do from a computational science point of view, right? Sparsity is what helps you in fast computation in general. If you have sparsity, you are happy. Except this is the wrong kind of sparsity. Because here the sparsity is not zeros, here is the sparsity, this sparsity here is unknown values. And dealing with unknown values is interesting. Okay. In fact, what I said was, for the unknown values, I actually just, you know, the simple idea here is to actually impute values for them. Okay. A different idea, which actually you could try, is let's assume that if I have vector v1 and vector v2, okay, I will combine v1 dot v2 only over the dimensions for which they have non-null values. These are two vectors, okay. So v1 is 5 null value, 4, 3 null value. V2 is null value 5, 3, 2 null value. Okay? In that case, I can then define the dot product of these vectors in terms of dot product only of these two. I mean, just summation. So this is 12 plus 6. That's the only thing. Because you don't quite know what is 5 times an unknown value is. That's a different way. In one way, we actually went ahead and removed this null value and, for example, said 5 plus 4, 9 plus 3, 12 over 3 values. So it looks like the user's approximate average rating is 4. So I put a 4 here and a 4 here. In that case, I can do normal dot product. In another case, I refuse to do that and then only compute this dot product between vectors on the dimensions that they share in common. Now, if you do that, if you think in terms of vectors, right, this is a crazy thing that's going on right now, because I am essentially saying things like, what is the distance between, rather than talking about what's the angle between a vector and another vector, I am essentially going to be talking about what's the angle between a vector and a plane, for example. Because, you know, you don't have, you know, if you are missing one of the dimensions, then that means it becomes a hyperplane. That's what you're doing geometrically, okay? Now, this looks like a dumb idea, and you don't want to try and do this. That's why in the last class, I tried pushing more the imputation method. The reason all of this is interesting is if you come to, and if you actually go and spend time reading this, how many of you actually opened this PDF file? Okay, the rest of you should at least open it. Okay, just make me happy once. I mean, because I keep thinking that when I'm sending this stuff, there are legions of people opening these and reading this, and you know, it'll be nice to humor me once in a while. Especially now that we only have 5 more classes left, and you know, the time when I convert numbers into letters is going to come close. Anyway, so in the case of this, basically, if you read that paper, you'll notice that they actually wound up doing LSI analysis, okay, on the data. So first of all, there are 2 points with respect to this particular slide. If we could use correlations, like item correlations, using the association clusters and scalar clusters, then what else do we have that we can still use? Latent semantic indexing, right? Latent semantic indexing tries to find the real latent dimensions on which the data is actually best, is varying the most. Okay? And then if you just take the top k of those dimensions and then consider users as well as items as vectors in those dimensions, and then you start taking their dot product similarity in the new dimensions, then you would essentially be doing an LSI based analysis. Okay? So the good part is, in fact, this picture sort of shows that if you were to do LSI somehow on the user item matrix, okay, and in fact for the Netflix prize, the items are all movies, right? And if you were to, for example, take the top 2 factors, remember LSI has document, factor term. Okay, so the term is the movie in this case. So if you were to then write the movies in the 2 dimensions corresponding to the top 2 factors, you know, he actually shows, you know, if you actually see enough movies, you know, in Hollywood, then you might be able to tell whether or not this looks like a reasonable structuring of the movie data. Okay, it does look like some movies are close, some movies are farther, and they're close and farther in this space of 2 dimensions. Whereas normally these movies can't even be visualized in two dimensions because they are k-dimensional vectors, where n-dimensional vectors, where n is the number of users. And Netflix has, I guess, 500,000 users, let's say. So it's a 500-dimensional vector, and in that 500-dimensional space, it's very hard to see any pattern. But if you were to do LSI and just take the top two dimensions, and then plot the movies in that, this is not unlike, by the way, that database statistics example that I kept talking about during LSI, remember? Right? Because I had there, it was a 10-dimensional data, and where it was hard to tell, I think 6-dimensional data, 6 terms, and it was hard to tell that the top 5 are somehow about databases and bottom 5 are about statistics. We knew this, but it wasn't obvious for the system. But if you were to do LSI and take the top 2 factors, then you saw that all the database ones were coming closer in that two-dimensional space, and all the statistics ones are going off into a different cluster. Okay, so you could do that here, and the good news is Netflix prize was won by a system which did this kind of latent factor analysis. So, I remember that when we asked for like a midterm feedback, some people hated LSI, okay? Learn to love it, because it's an idea, the idea of dimensionality reduction and factor, latent factor finding is a very useful one in general. The second issue, of course, is how did he do this? To be able to do this, he had to deal with this technical problem, which is how to compute the distance between, the similarity between two vectors when you have null values, okay? And remember, basically you were finding low rank approximations to the term document term matrix, okay? Now, those approximations are well defined only if the values are known in the document, in the matrix. Now, you're putting these null values in them. What is that supposed to mean then? Okay, so there are two ways you could do it. One is all the missing values, you impute some values to them, putting averages in that. The other idea, as I said, is only take the dot product on the dimensions that actually they share. The problem normally with this idea is that it tends to overfit, which basically means that you try to just miss, you try to learn the noise in the data too. Okay, and to avoid that, overfitting, for example, you put a bias on the learner and say the complex hypothesis would be penalized. Okay, so for example, when was the last time we looked at complex hypothesis being penalized? In the k-means, remember? In the k-means clustering, when I talked about looking at k-means as an optimization problem, it wasn't obvious what should be the value of k, and one way is to actually do the whole thing and look for kinks in the k-means, in terms of the intra-cluster tightness, okay, as the number of clusters increase. You know it becomes zero when it becomes as many as the number of clusters, but then, you could look for the kinks. The other idea I also said was you could just pose this as an optimization problem, where the objective function penalizes the number of clusters. More clusters, you'll get a penalty. Less clusters, so the amount of penalty you get would be proportional to the number of clusters. And then if you were to optimize that objective function, essentially you would be forced towards fewer clusters. Okay, just a second. So what they do in this particular case is, it's worth looking at this. So notice that the objective function for low rank approximation in general is this is the user's rating for ith term, okay, minus this is the predicted rating. If you were to put the qi is the item in factor space, okay, and p of u is the user in factor space. Okay, so if you were to take the dot product of those two vectors, which is basically qi transpose of p of u, right, that would be the similarity between these, and that you can think of that as the rating the user would have given to this particular item. Okay, you subtract the predicted rating from the real rating, square it, and you want to reduce this sum. While the number, the big thing of course is the size of these two documents, which is both the Q vector and the P vector only have F number of dimensions, which is the number of factors. And if you were to decide F to be like 7, then the final matrix, the approximation you get, will have rank 7. Okay? So of all the rank 7 matrices, which one would have the smallest distance from the true value? Okay? And to avoid the overfitting, what you do is essentially you put a penalty on the sizes of the coordinates for the users and the movies in the factor space. Okay? So the idea is that you want to avoid saying that each factor represents a particular user, let's say, in which case that user will have like infinite weight in that direction and zero weight in every other direction. Okay? So one way you actually are putting the penalty, and this penalty term is similar to putting a penalty on the number of clusters. The more the clusters, you know, the higher this would be, and you are trying to minimize this whole expression, so your optimizer will look for fewer number of clusters. Similarly here, the smaller this value, you know, the better off you are, for which you need to reduce the size of the factor, the coordinates in the factor space. The magnitude of the coordinates in the factor space. It's an interesting way of reducing stopping the overfitting. Okay? And then, in essence, previously you did not have this, and this minimization, the answer for this minimization turns out to be singular value decomposition. You do SVD and take the first F factors, and that would be the answer that minimizes this. But when you throw this in, it's no longer SVD. And so you actually optimize by a local search, and I think the Netflix guy basically says he does a stochastic gradient descent. Okay? The reason I'm bringing this all up is not so much that I'm dying to put this on the test, which would be a nice thing to do, but I want you to understand that, you know, the techniques you learned in the beginning of the semester are all connected to pretty much, you know, what went on to win the Netflix prize. So, but for lack of time and timing, I mean, lack of, I guess, competence and timing, you could have also won $1 million. Yes?
We're talking about the winner a lot of the Netflix prize. It was my understanding that there are a lot of teams that were very, very similar at the top. Were they all using these types of methods?
Not all of them are using the same type of method, but this is a good enough reason to remember, right? You know, the point is, the statistically speaking, if the idea that we are talking about is particularly useless, then nobody would have used them, let alone the winning guy. Okay, that paper basically talks about the fact that many other people used variety of latent factor analysis. Okay. There is, in fact, the CACM version of that paper says it's not enough to just go with this, you then have to do a little bit more on top. For example, he winds up adding additional sorts of analysis apart from just collaborative filtering.
Yeah,
plus also the temporal drift. Okay, but the big point I want you to understand is this as a whole is quite relevant for collaborative filtering. Latent semantic indexing, which you heard of before, and we were slightly depressed, I think, you know, that why should we know something that Google isn't using? And, you know, Google doesn't seem to be using latent semantic indexing. Why are you forcing us to learn this? Why are you asking us questions on a midterm? Well, you know, I mean, $1 million is like loose change for Google, but may not be for you. But more interestingly, it's a deeper idea, and, you know, to reduce the dimensionality of the data. And you would try it when you have new problems. That was the point. Okay? Yes, sir?
So, in the Pearson coefficient calculation, we also have the same problem, like dot product with null product, null.
Yeah, but basically they were ignoring all the, so the idea is Pearson correlation coefficient did not try to say it's a distance. Did not try to say it's a distance. So, it has no geometric interpretation. So first of all, the way we calculated the Pearson correlation coefficient is only over the dimensions on which both of them have ratings. Only on those did you compute the thing. So in fact, you did this. Okay? So it looks like if this is a mistake in terms of overfitting, so it should also be the problem for Pearson correlation coefficient. The only point is that correlation is not supposed to have any geometric interpretation. If it's a correlation over fully specified vector, then it turns out it also can be seen as a vector similarity. Then you would like to see that it has a geometric significance. But then when you come here, then you will be wondering what happened to the geometric significance. Now you are considering distances between vectors and hyperplane. Okay? Yes?
You are saying that involved in the
derivation of the metric interpretation. No, all I'm saying is that Pearson correlation is defined only on the dimensions which are shared between the two vectors. Okay? And yet we did not particularly worry about does that have any, is that violating anything? Okay? Because it's a correlation over the things that we both rated. That's all. Whereas if you want to convert this into some sort of a distance between two vectors, then why are you only considering some dimensions of the vector? Is the question. Okay. So you notice, of course, that two vectors, two three-dimensional vectors, is it not possible that they could have zero similarity in the full three dimensions, and yet their projection into any particular two-dimensional plane can have close to one similarity? Think about this. And if that isn't possible, remember, how many of you know this? People from like India, for example, know this, that when there's a power cut, then you have a candle, and then people put their hands in front of the candle and then make nice little three-dimensional things, and then on the wall, suddenly you start having a bird floating, etc., etc. This stuff, if you look at the hands, you look like this guy is a maniac, but on the wall, it looks like a very different thing because the projections are not directly connected to the three-dimensional space. Okay, so I just thought I couldn't, resist making these connections because, it's something where you are very close to the state of the art, and I thought you might want to know that. Okay. So, now let's start talking about a completely different topic, which is essentially exploiting structures on the web, for example. And this is a slide you must remember, you probably do remember from the very beginning class, that structure helps. Okay, so for example, a generic web page containing text, a movie review, an employee record, and this can be represented, let's say, some natural language, and this can be represented, let's say, in a relational database, and you query this using SQL, which is like a database querying. This, you query this using keywords, which is what you've been doing all this while. Presumably, you know some of this if you have done databases, and you pretty much know all of this because you suffered through this course. Okay? Now, the question is, if I have a review, a movie review, or an Amazon book record, which I actually mentioned in the last class, an Amazon book record or a movie review are basically in between these two because they have some structure, and then within that structure they also allow basically free form text. An Amazon book record will have title field, which is a bunch of text, an author field, which is a bunch of text, a review field, which is a bunch of text. Okay, so there is structure. And as I mentioned, the word trash is unlikely to occur. Occurring in the review field has a very different meaning. Even with our craziness about bag of words, right, you don't expect to see the word trash being used liberally in the review field. Whereas it can be used in the title without changing the quality of the book. Right? So in general, you would like to actually deal with this kind of data because you know this kind of data, how to deal with it from the database side. You know this kind of data, how to deal with this from this course. And if you have structure, then you would like to basically specify the structure, extract the structure, and use the structure. And before you get there, the question, of course, is why does structure help? I mean, so suppose if there is structure, one idea you can do is ignore it so that it will become this. So anywhere you are in the middle of these two things, right, you can push it either to this side or push it to this side. Okay? How do you push it to this side? Ignore all the structure. Yes, basically take the entire set of Amazon record and say it's a single file. Okay, I willfully ignore the fact that there is a review field and there is a title field. I just assume all of them together is one single file. Okay, and if I do that, it better be the case that I would be losing something. Otherwise, it would be much nicer to do that because I don't need to learn anything new. Right? And then the other idea is to push it to this extreme. So you take the Amazon book or the email and say anything which doesn't have structure, I ignore. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I ignore that, and my classic example of that, I don't know whether I mentioned it to you or not, that when I was in grade school, they used to teach us that sound has three characteristics, right? Pitch, intensity, quality. Right? This is highly structured. Pitch, you can give a quantitative number for it. Okay? Given a sound wave, you can actually talk about a particular song or something, you can actually talk about high pitch, low pitch, etc. Intensity, is it loud or is it not loud? Quality is everything else. Okay? Quality is where people write big reviews saying this particular singer seems to have a tonality and this, you know, various kinds of soothing sounds, etc., etc. And you hear that and you can decide to buy the CD or you can say just buy it yourself and feel whether it has quality or not. We don't quite know how to quantify the quality. Okay? Now, if I have a database of all the songs, I'm Pandora. Right? If I'm Pandora, then the easiest way to put these into databases is just take pitch and intensity. And then classify all music by saying, you tend to like very screechy music. So here is, since you liked screechy heavy metal music, I'll give you screechy North Indian classical music. Now you'll be saying, what the heck is this? Other than the screechiness, they have nothing in common. But I ignored this part because it doesn't fit well in my database. Right? So you can go from here to here by getting rid of the structure, or you can go from here to here by throwing out anything that is not structured enough. Okay? But if you want to stay in the middle, there better be the reason, a reason as to what good things will happen if you actually were to reason about representations here. And to talk about that, we mentioned last time that structure helps expressive queries, and there are certain kinds of queries which you cannot ask at the keyword level. Okay? And obviously, going to and saying that I would just ignore anything which doesn't have structure would push me into that kind of scenarios where I will be trying to classify songs in terms of just the quantifiable attributes rather than unquantifiable attributes, which are probably very important. Okay? So we decided upfront that structure helps querying, and then we sort of said the question is challenges in how to actually exploit structure on, let's say, web data. Okay? So topic 3 for this course, which unfortunately I was hoping that we'll have about 7 classes, but now it's more like 4.5 classes, given fact that I already lost half today, is going to be about structure and the question, and then there are 3 pieces to the structure issue. One is, if you agree that using structure will improve your querying, okay, and your experience of querying the data, then you have these issues: first, getting the structure, then using the structure, and then third, combining structure across sources. Okay, And this, let me spend a few minutes in this because this is the overview of the next four classes, basically. Okay? So the first question is, if structure is so big, such a big deal, how do you get the structure? How do you know that something has structure? If you're coming from the IR side, you would need to know that Amazon has structure. Okay? So the one way is to allow languages which allow you to specify that from here to here is the title, from here to here is the author name, and from here to here is the review. Right? I mean, I would not, although I haven't yet formally suggested and formally introduced to you XML, I pretty much assume that everybody knows what XML is to some extent. And all you do is you'll say title begin, blah, 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 title end. Okay? Author begin, blah, 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 author end. If I just did this, this is actually telling my system now, a simple parser can say, okay, this must be, this stuff must be something of the form title. I don't quite know what title means, by the way, but this must be title. And this must be author, this must be the review. So as simple as it might sound, finding, you know, providing a machine readable specification of structure is an important one. How do you know it? Because you actually have other kinds of visual cues. For example, you know, you would have seen that they wrote author in bold letters. And so, and then they put a couple of, you know, double column there. So you think, oh, author must be a field. Okay? And basically, your systems would have harder time dealing with that. So to make their life simple, you would actually like to provide a more machine-readable specification of structure. The whole point of XML is to make machine-readable specification of structure. Okay. However, having said that, it is possible to read too much into this stuff. All we know is whatever stuff is in here, it is of this type. Unfortunately, the word title means something to you guys because you know English. Okay? So, but for your machine, it doesn't mean anything. But your program, it doesn't mean anything. So, in fact, the best thing to think of this is think of this as field one, end of field one. Right? That's what it really is. Okay, now if I have that, so then we will look at XML because it allows us to specify structure when there is something to be specified, and it allows us to just ignore structure when there isn't any. So for example, a pure text file is an XML file, it turns out. Okay, and you can always take, if you want to make it have some kind of a field, you can just say body begin, body end. There, you put some structure to it, but you haven't changed the file really. So essentially, whatever you do in the, you know, converting something into XML form, basically giving it an XML form, is if you have structure to provide, you will provide it. Otherwise, it can just be doing whatever it was doing before. Okay, so that's specification of structure. Now, if people did not take the time in specifying the structure, okay, for example, I kept talking about the scholar.google, remember? Which goes and eats all the PDF files corresponding to essentially technical papers. And then it uses that information to compute such statistics as how many people are citing this paper, what other papers were written by the authors of this paper, things like that. To be able to do that, it needs to realize that a paper has a structure, that there is a title block and there is an author block normally. There is the body of the paper, there is the end part called references. Okay, now, if we all agree that all our papers should be machine parsable, we would have probably agreed upon some XML syntax for every possible paper. We agree on general syntax, right? For example, have you ever seen a paper in computer science course, I can stop there, and some of you say no, but let me continue. Have you ever seen a paper in computer science which starts with the references, then has the author name, then some body, and then some abstract, and so on? It doesn't change the paper. But we all agreed that let's all stick to one format for the paper. There should be like a title on the top, then there will be author names, and then the ever-changing name of the computer science department below it, and then other things, right? That's what we agreed on, right? So if we can agree on that, maybe we could have agreed on actually putting some XML structure, some tag structure to it, saying title, begin, title, end, author, begin, author, end. Unfortunately, since we don't really believe that machines read our papers, we haven't actually stuck to a specific XML structure yet. So most of us still write papers in and then they're just uploaded in some PDF or PostScript form. So what does Google Scholar do? It can just assume, I'll just assume they're text files and do normal IR on it. Or I'll know that there is structure out there, let me extract it. That's what Google Scholar does. It actually goes and automatically tries to extract structure from the PDF file. That's how it figures out the name of the paper, the title of the paper, authors of the paper, etc. And that's also the reason why every once in a while Google Scholar makes mistakes. So for example, I don't know whether I may have mentioned this in the beginning of the class, that I had a paper once which had two lines of title. Okay, it was something called Learning Techniques for Planning, and it said looking back, taking stock, and going forward. And then it was written by a student of mine called Terry Zimmerman and myself, right? And Google's Scholar looked at this PDF file. You know, it used its heuristics for figuring out what is the title, what is the author name, and decided that these are the authors. Because normally nobody has multi-line titles, and looking back, taking stock, going forward looks like an author. So all the citations for this paper were going to L back, T stock, and G forward. And if you find them, please, you know, yell at them, because I'm losing my citation index because of that. So the point is, A, structure would be extracted because it's worth extracting, even though it cannot be foolproof. Even though I can bitch and moan saying, oh my God, the three citations for this paper went to these people who don't even exist, whereas it could have helped my citation index by about 50%, right? Instead of that, I could also say, well, at least for the other papers, I actually have a way of telling what are important papers, what are not important papers. You know, basically sort of a link analysis can now be done because they have figured out the references. They can then make connections between papers and other papers, which were present through English previously. Now they are machine readable connections. Okay, so as far as getting structure is concerned, we will look at XML, which is starting today's class, and XML's, and if you specify structure using XML, how do you exploit it from an IR technique point of view, and how do you exploit it from a database point of view? Because remember, XML is smack dab in the middle. Okay, so in fact, if you are a IR guy, you think, wow, this thing has more structure than just plain old English. And if you're a database guy, you say, that's paradise lost, because I used to have more structure, but here this has less structure. And I still need to deal with this less structure because bozos in the world on the web seem to be putting unstructured data on the web. And I have database managers to sell. And I can't say, first clean up your data, then you can use my managers. Then nobody will buy it. Okay? So from a database point of view, they are interested in figuring out how to deal with less structure. And from the IR point of view, they're interested in finding out how to exploit more structure. It's the same question because you're in the middle. And we'll ask about both of those. We'll talk about both of those. Okay? And that's getting structure part. Now, so that's the XML part. The other part is, if you don't have the structure, you try to extract it. Extracting the structure is now, there's a whole field called information extraction, which is what are systematic ways to extract, for example, titles, authors, fields from papers. What are systematic ways to extract addresses from, you know, postcards? And of course, we no longer have postcards. You know, this is a research problem that's now gone out the window. But there used to be a post office. You know, I don't know, some of you may or may not know this. And, you know, people used to write by hand, you know, the address and so on. And so they had to actually read these things and say, who is this letter going to? What is their street address, etc., etc. And we do all sorts of crazy things in writing, right? And we would do all sorts of shortenings. And sometimes we will put the city name as well as the street name in the same line. Sometimes we don't. And you still... the long-suffering post person will be able to figure that out still and extract the information and then put it in the right place. Okay, but now your machines have to do that. That's information extraction. And even if it's all text, even if it's not handwritten, remember the PDF extraction, that's an important issue. In the PDF file, where is abstract, where is title, which part of is the references, in each reference, what are the author names, what is the title of the paper? Okay, and in doing the extraction, a related question essentially is sometimes, related to Google Scholar. You know, since I'm a professor, all my life revolves around citations. So unfortunately, if you may not care about this, but so this guy Jim Handler, who was my former advisor, he is again. I may have mentioned this. If so, just tell me that you mentioned this. So he had co-authored this paper with the. What's the guy, the World Wide Web guy?
Tim Berners-Lee
and Ora Lassila and Semantic Web, which by the way, we'll be talking about in the third part, okay? And so this paper got like tons of citations, like 4,000 citations. So he used to be a happy man. And one day, for some reason, they improved the extraction record in Google Scholar and decided Handler is no longer the author of this paper because they didn't extract Handler out of the author names. Maybe he put himself in the third level or something like that. So suddenly now his citation index, citation numbers went from whatever, 40,000 to 2 or 3. So he then tried to tell, Tim Berners-Lee and Ora Lassila, can you guys see, how this Google is messing up? And apparently Ora Lassila said, who are you? Because if Google Scholar doesn't think you're an author, then you're not an author of this paper. Okay, right? So, in fact, I have my own small story of another paper which I have written with my papers, and I was actually the first author, and they just said, first author, forget it. And so I don't get that citations in my list. Okay, again, the point I'm trying to make here is when you are extracting, in this particular case, there can be errors, and in another issue related to extraction is sometimes, those of you who write papers, you try to, remember, you write tons and tons of pages, and in the last minute, you need to fit this into 4 pages. And the first thing that goes is the references. So you would say, people, paper, stop. Right? Because you don't give all the details about what's the names of the authors. And some of these people from Asia have really long names, and it takes extra lines. And so you just want to shorten it like very mercilessly. And shorten the title too mercilessly. And then shorten the name of the conference to almost unbelievably short form. Like ICE, I-C-E. What is ICE? Well, if you don't know what ICE is, you're not supposed to ask me, right? Now, the question, of course, is suppose somebody wrote ICE in one reference, and somebody wrote whatever ICE is. Do you know what ICE is? I don't know, International Conference on E, okay? Right, I don't know what the heck is ICE. So then International Conference on E, now these two are the same paper. You need to realize that these two papers are talking about the same conference. And similarly, some people call me R. Kamham Party. And so in fact, even when they cite my papers, they write it as R. Kamham Party, because they think I'm Rao Kamham Party. But my full name is Subba Rao Kamham Party, so I write it as S. Kamham Party. R. Kamham Party and S. Kamham Party are the same. And again, please take part in my quest. We want to make sure that I get all the citations plus other people's citations. I don't want to lose any of my own citations, right? So again, if I do this, I have a leakage of citations. There are like two people, one called R. Kamham Party and one called S. Kamham Party. Now I have to find out what are all my alter egos and keep adding them and tell my chair that, look, there is this R. Kamham Party guy who's really smart, but that's me, okay, because he also is getting citations. The point here is these two entities are the same. And you have to figure this out. When you extract and find the structure, you actually have to realize this stuff too. And this is called named entity resolution. And It's a problem very closely connected to information extraction. And that sort of becomes part of that too. That's in the first part, getting structure. Okay. The second is using structure. If you were to be given structure, how do you go about using it? You would not even have done this unless there was some hope here, right? Because why the heck, I mean, you're not trying to impress anybody. You know, you want to actually use the structure to improve, retrieval and query processing. For retrieval, we will talk about, for example, extending IR techniques such that if you have structure, how do you, for example, support keyword queries when there is structure? Okay, it's an interesting point. For example, when there is structure, it turns out the following, for example, that suppose there is, previously there's a word Rav, let's say in the document, it would be basically in your inverted index, you would just have to say in this document, there are 15 instances of Rav. But if I actually have structure to this file and there is an author field where there are one instance of Rav and there is a body where there is five instances of Rav and there are references where there are seven instances of Rav, these are all different Ravs. Because I could be asking you, show me all the papers that seem to cite Rav's papers. I could be asking you, show me all the papers that seem to be citing Rav's papers that are not written by Rav. Right? Because otherwise, you know, people always write. One reason for writing papers is to cite your own old papers that nobody else is reading. Okay? So, now the point is that when you do this, now one single word, Rav, now has to get split into an author Rav. Okay, body Rav, five, reference Rav, 10. The more the structure, the more fragmentation of Rav. Do you see what I'm saying? So inverted indexes become larger, not smaller, but larger when you have structure. This is something that you want to understand. Okay, you have more structure, that means things appearing in different pieces of the file now have different meanings. Okay, previously you had, the last time you saw something like this was where? Header, Rav, footnote, tiny font, Rav, in an HTML file. And these were different Ravs too. Except you could combine them. You could say header Rav is two times the number of header Ravs plus one time the number of normal font Ravs plus 0.7 times the number of tiny sized Ravs. And that would just become the weight of this single word. Do you remember this? Right? In Google, you recompute the weight so that a word occurring in the header will get a little bit of an extra push. But in the inverted index, that word occurs only once. It's just its weight change. But when you really have structure where this was just syntactic display, so you didn't expect this to mean anything meaningful. Whereas here, since the author and the body and the references could be completely different semantic fields, you want to differentiate their occurrences and across these. Right? And so you would actually increase the size of the inverted index. And furthermore, the other question is, so that's the background. The second question, of course, is what kind of queries can you support? Do you still support normal keyword queries? Or do you allow people to ask structured queries? So for example, in fact, they can ask, give me cited, give me all the documents where references Rav and author not Rav. Okay, that would be a structured query. You can answer this. But the point is, just because you are supporting structured queries doesn't necessarily mean that people on the web are going to ask structured queries. You are, smart people, right? How often have you actually used, Google supports this kind of stuff, right? It will basically say, you know, it'll allow you to give advanced querying without just not just keywords, but also field names. Okay, how often have you done these kinds of queries at all? And if you are lazy bum, then why do you expect normal people who haven't even taken this course to be suddenly asking really strong, you know, structured queries? The point is, if people ask structured queries, you want to support them. If they don't, you still want to be able to do a better job in answering their queries because you have structure. This becomes an interesting question as to what does it mean if I have a keyword query and, you know, I can either use a set of XML files or just set of text files, equivalent text files. Can I do better job of answering this query on the XML files rather than the text files? Okay, as a hint, for example, if the thing occurred in the header, right, we used to give it higher weight previously. The fact that you kept differentiating word occurrence in the headers versus footnote size allowed you to separate, you know, a document's relevance to the query when the query term appears in the header of the document versus somewhere in the middle. You could do that here too. Okay, so those are things that we'll talk about. And from the point of view of databases, this is from the IR side, from the point of view of databases, you would be interested in seeing now that XML can sort of be seen as database if only with less structure, how much of the SQL style ideas will work for this. Okay, and in fact, there is this idea that we'll try to talk about, there is this standard called XQuery, which basically allows you to ask, it's a strict superset of SQL. And it allows you to ask all the SQL queries plus more. Okay? And so it, for example, can connect SQL queries plus keyword queries plus everything in between. Now, of course, it's there, and the reference document for XQuery is like about that size, and it's growing because people want to add even more kinds of queries to it. And the number of X queries that are actually submitted anywhere in the world is much smaller because, you know, on the web, nobody really asks any X queries. But if you actually have a database and a database manager who is used to writing a two-page SQL query might not mind writing a three-page X query if they can do better job of dealing with data which is not fully structured. Okay, so that's something that we'll talk about. And then finally, the third part is this issue that if in fact, remember I said that just because there is structure doesn't mean just because, suppose I have a book source, I mean Amazon, which says author, Rao, author. Let's say Barnes & Noble, I don't think they do it this way, but suppose Barnes & Noble writes writer, Rao, writer. Okay, as long as you're only dealing with Amazon books, all Amazon books hopefully will be consistent. They, you know, all the authors of the books would be prefaced by author begin, author end. But you go out of Amazon, they can make up their own tags. They can make up their own tags, okay? And they can be consistent by themselves, but they don't have to be consistent with Amazon. Now, sometimes there are commercial reasons for standardization. In fact, some of the best examples of the success of XML come from micro industries where people actually got together and standardized their tags, and they'll all use those same tags. So you can now write programs which can assume that if there is the word price occurring in the tag, it has the following semantics. The semantics come from the procedure. Basically, you would add up the numbers in the two price fields. Okay? Whereas if you do not agree on this, then one guy can write price and say hi. And another guy can write price and say 7.50. What is high plus 7.50? what is high minus 7.50. That's basically because one guy is using price as a categorical attribute, another guy is using price as a numerical attribute. The only way they will, and then of course, in fact, they can also be, as I said here, somebody else might be calling the price field the cost. So you have both heterogeneity in the tag names and the heterogeneity in the value types used within the tags. Okay, so when you cross over sources, you know, when you're dreaming about structure, the best thing, of course, is to be able to support a sort of a meta search over multiple structured sources. Okay, how many meta search engines do you know? A whole lot, right? I mean, basically, have you ever traveled on a flight? And if you did, then you would be using something like, you know, Expedia, which is actually a meta search engine, or Kayak, which is actually a meta search over meta search engines. Because Kayak calls United and Southwest. No, it doesn't call Southwest. Okay, there's a whole entire story as to why nobody calls Southwest. Okay, because they really are just jealous of Southwest. But plus, of course, Southwest doesn't give the API. But it's actually very relevant to our discussion. So they, let me get to Southwest in a minute. They basically wind up, you know, aggregating the flight information from all the possible flight sources. Now, if flights were doing this kind of nonsense, saying price you don't want to know, or price too high, or price $750, or cost $450, if they have this kind of heterogeneity, then these guys would be stuck trying to figure out, you know, what, how to compare things right. Okay, so that is an industry where people have standardized the tags. Everybody would export their flights information in the same exact format. Okay, and then let me give you one more example of, I mean, there are more examples of that stuff. Okay, these are whole bunch of other micro industries who have standardized their tags because of commercial incentives. Okay, so for example, extensible financial reporting markup language, XFRML, extensible business reporting language, XBRL, music XML, spacecraft markup language, and in fact I read somewhere THML, theological markup language, which tries to differentiate between different religions. So you can aggregate and ask, like, you know, we always wanted, what's the right religion I should subscribe to, given that I have already sinned, and I want to go for the religion that is kind of easy on this particular kind of sin. For the next 2 days, I would go to that church. So, you know, this meta search engine on, you know, using THML can tell you, for example, which is the best religion for you for the next 2 days, okay? I'm not making it up. So the point, of course, is that all these languages essentially are because people agreed to standardize. And people only agree to standardize if there is some kind of an incentive for them to standardize. Okay? So, for example, you know, like one of the first things, even before XML, is electronics business vendors. Electronics vendors, you know, how many of you have seen all these resistors, capacitances? I mean, you are computer science people. One day, you at some point of time, you must have done some of this stuff, right? I mean, there's this huge number of these thingamajigs, right? And then you can't just say, give me some of those red ones. The red ones have to be specified exactly. And you want to know who is selling this red one cheaper than somebody else, right? And so the entire electronics industry agreed upon the tags for resistors, capacitances, you know, all these things, okay? And then they will put their catalogs in the same exact format. If they don't, what do they lose? They lose business. Because any aggregator who is trying to look at all the electronics vendors would lose these guys. Okay? So, now, if this happens, then the third part is not a problem. If people have already agreed that there is an incentive for them to standardize, the third part is not a problem. But most of the time, there are, you know, while there are a large number of sources which have kind of agreed for specific domains, overall the web is a decentralized, uncontrolled, non-authoritarian environment where people can call anything anything, and in fact would insist on doing so. Right? Then you need technologies that will take different sources using different tags. These tags are also oftentimes called metadata. And you need to integrate these metadata into the same form. And there are multiple ways of doing it. You could, for example, decide, you, the mediator, I mean, so you basically have, you know, here's the web, and then you will write a mediator, which then connects to all the sources on the web, okay, and then decides to, and basically maps their tags such that, you know, you would say basically that the author here is the same as writer here. Okay? So there is some sort of a mapping table you keep that you have to somehow get. Once you have this mapping table, then you know how to essentially compare the data from here to data from here with respect to this mapping. Right? This is essentially the third, the word information integration. It's a pretty big dream, which is, if in fact information has structure, it somehow should be able to combine the structures across all the sources and support one simple interface to all the structured sources. Okay? If you are a database guy, you would think that interface should be just a database manager. And it somehow, the big issue is how to deal with this challenge. How do you map sources across on top of each other? Now, for this problem too, there are two ways of doing it. One is you learn to automatically decide that the author here seems to be the same as writer here, you the mediator. So you would realize that the same thingies are occurring in the author field as in the writer field over multiple data instances. So you start out with some statistical accuracy, decide that author seems to be reasonable map to a writer. So you can learn the alignment schema. Okay, alignment mapping. The other idea is let people do it. Let the source providers do it. Okay, if you allow the source providers to do it, the idea then is each source provider gets to write whatever they want. They can say writer here, okay, and then so they have a source, and then they have metadata where they will say for all x, writer x implies author x, and they might also say for all x, poet x implies author X, and maybe there is a separate thing, separate entry called Leaves of Grass and W. Whitman, and then you said poet for this. Okay, so the source essentially maps each schema to some other schema, and then that some other schema, maybe there is another source which also maps it to the schema. Maybe there is a set of extra sources which map their schemas into a different schema, and then there are linking assertions between this top schema and this top schema. If you have this, it all becomes a simple set of logical chaining, saying your poet is the same as this guy's author. This guy's author seems to be the same as this guy's writer. So your writer and this guy's poet is the same. I did not have to learn this. I just followed the leads you provided to me. There is a fundamental difference in assumptions about who does the work. The first case, you assume source providers will never agree to do any standardization. In the second case, you assume that source providers may not standardize to the level that the electronics vendors have agreed, but they might allow themselves to write whatever they want, but provide some reasonable mapping statements. If you believe in this, what is the dream you are believing in? That's called semantic web. That's the direction semantic web goes through, where they assume that, you know, you get to write whatever you want as long as you put a bunch of annotations in some language that we all agree on. And the language they agree on would be a logical language. In particular, they will use description logics to say this class. So for example, the poet class, in this particular case, the one I wrote here, the poet class is a subset of the author class. Description logics talk about class subsumption relations. As long as people provide this, you take them at the face value, and then you make the integration feasible. Now, is semantic web a reasonable idea, or a machine learning a more reasonable idea? So actually, in fact, for source alignment, we really talked about three distinct ideas. One is one size fits all. Which is basically the electronic, EBXML, the music XML, etc. Where if you have a music source, you better write them in the agreed upon tags. If you have an electronics vendor, you better write this in the agreed upon tags. Okay? And then that's one end. The other end is, it's a jungle out there. And in the case of jungle out there, everybody makes their own tags, and you learn tag correspondence. Obviously, learning is not going to be foolproof. This will be foolproof to the extent that people agreed upon the same thing. The middle is multiple sizes, but mapping are provided. That means you get to use your own lingo as long as you provide a dictionary saying, for me, poet is author in the standard language. And somebody else writes something else, they will also say their field corresponds to author. And then you now have a chaining between these two. Okay, now this is the semantic web. And this is, you know, pre-standardization. And this is the, you know, wide web, where nobody listens to anybody. Now, which is right? Well, it depends on the scenario. So for electronics vendors, this was right enough. Okay. Whereas this one assumes it might, for example, be very useful, may not be useful at the web scale, because since you have no control over who makes the source, you have no control over whether their mapping is actually believable or not. However, in an intra-corporate scenario where there are multiple databases, you know, maybe throwing in this kind of semantic web mappings might be able to allow you to combine sources. And then this, on the other hand, is, you just have to learn from scratch. Okay? So this is basically what we'll try to do. If I don't complete all of this, then at least you knew what I was trying to do before the class ended and you celebrated. Okay? We'll stop here. Next class, we'll talk about XML in IR, XML in XQuery, and then continue on to semantic web standards. Thank you.